From Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Well, that was quick. One day after 29,000 California State University faculty members launched a week-long strike at all 23 campuses, including Sac State, where Cap Radio is located, late last night, a tentative deal has been reached between the California Faculty Association and the Cal State system. This morning, it is back to business for the largest public university system in the country. So now, it's all about the details. Ashley Smith is a higher education reporter with EdSource and returns with a look at what finally brought the two sides to agree after months of stalls and broken off negotiations. Welcome back, Ashley.
Thanks, Vicky.
You were here 24 hours ago talking to us about this historic system-wide strike. The stalemate wasn't looking good. What changed in less than 24 hours?
Well, I think empty classrooms. There were students who were reporting that they might have been the only person in their class and empty campuses. I think that both sides came to the table late in the afternoon yesterday. And the faculty union also wanted to get back in the classroom. And so, you know, ultimately both groups compromised.
Yeah. And I know that, you know, when it comes to salary and that salary increase, they were apart on what they wanted. The faculty union wanted a 12% pay increase plus stronger benefits as well. The Cal State system was offering 5% for each of the three consecutive years. I mean, I know it gets complicated, but overall, what does this tentative deal entail? What did they agree to?
Well, the faculty will ultimately get a 10% increase. So 5% retroactive to July 2023 and 5% starting July this year. And of course, that is contingent on what the legislature does. The lowest paid faculty, they will see an additional $3,000 retroactive to last year, and another $3,000 will kick in on July 1st. And, you know, that lowest paid faculty, the salary floor is around $54,000. So, an additional $6,000 would probably be a huge help for them. Mm.
Given that this is a tentative agreement that was reached last night, what needs to happen to make it stick?
Well, the union members still need to vote on it and to ratify this agreement. And that will take place probably in the next few weeks as they go over the details and hammer everything out and make sure that this is exactly what they want. And then once that occurs, this contract is good for another year. They won't be back to the bargaining table until next year.
Hmm. You know, given that you have spoken with faculty, you've spoken with students, you've heard from the university, the Cal State system. I mean, given that you've been following this since the beginning, I mean, this spans months, and this also spans like rolling one-day strikes that took place a month ago. Were you surprised that a deal was reached so quickly?
I was. But keep in mind that this was the first statewide strike for the nation's largest public university system. And I think that may have been the difference maker, as opposed to the rolling strikes and even the discussions, the back and forth that happened last year. Monday having classes and campuses virtually empty, I think that played a huge role.
Yeah, when you were talking with us yesterday, I mean, you mentioned that this isn't the only strike in California's higher education system recently. And on social media, once that tentative agreement was reached, the faculty union, the California Faculty Association, they posted, in case anyone forgot, strikes work. So where do you see this going, given that this isn't just an isolated incident, an isolated example?
Yeah, I mean, they followed behind the UC academic workers, the University of Southern California's graduate workers. I mean, strikes seem to work in California. And I talked to a couple of faculty members earlier today, and they said that they think that this is showing that the attacks on higher education that have been happening nationwide, that they can fight back, that they can stand up for people who work for colleges, for liberal arts education, and that perhaps California can be the example nationwide for how to fight for education workers.
Hmm. Finally, what are the next steps?
Well, once they ratify the contract, the next step is planning next year, what the demands will be in 2025 for once again coming back to the table and hammering out a new contract. And of course, we'll be keeping an eye on what happens in the legislature in July, because some of those pay increases are contingent on the legislature maintaining funding to the Cal State system. And so as long as that happens, then those extra increases for July, those will go through. So we'll be keeping an eye on that this summer.
Yep, and we are facing a budget deficit. Ashley, thank you so much for the update.
Sure, thank you, Vicki.
Ashley Smith is a higher education reporter with EdSource, updating us on a tentative deal being reached between the Cal State system and the faculty union. You're listening to Insight on CAP Radio. Owning a home in California has become more expensive and just ultimately more elusive than ever before. According to data published by Property Shark, California's homeownership rate, it ranks at the bottom. And as far as price goes, we are the most expensive by far when it comes to the lower 48. The average home in California now sells for around $750,000. Hawaii is the only state that's higher. So it's no wonder that a state program for first-time home buyers has been bombarded with interest. But landing one of these coveted loans has proven difficult and didn't necessarily reach the people it was intended to help. That's why the state is relaunching the California Dream for All Down Payment Assistance Program, and there are some important changes for round two. Joining us is CalMatters reporter Felicia Mello. Felicia reports on California's economic divide. Good morning, Felicia.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So let's just start with the 101, the basics. What is the California Dream for All program?
Yeah, absolutely. So the state launched the California Dream for All program last year. And as you mentioned, it was created to really deal with the state's highly expensive, competitive housing market that has really locked out many first-time home buyers from home ownership. And the idea was really to help first-time home buyers who may have the income to make monthly mortgage payments, but just haven't been able to save up the kind of high down payment you might need to buy an $800,000 home, say. So the state gives a first-time home buyer money for up to 20% of the home's purchase price. There is a cap of $150,000. And then the home buyer doesn't actually have to pay that money back until they sell the house. And then they also give the state a share of the appreciation in the home's value if the home does appreciate. So that's why it's called a shared appreciation loan, because the state is actually sharing in the appreciation of the house. And then in theory, the state can use the money it gets back to help future home buyers. So the state gave out almost $300 million this way in 2023, and it's getting ready to hand out another $250 million this spring.
What happens if, I mean, a lot of people keep their home and then they can pass it down in a trust. What happens if you don't sell the home?
Yeah, great question. So this is where the state is really assuming some risk in this program as well, right? They really only get paid when the home resells. So you could also theoretically have a situation where, you know, the home decreases in value. And in that situation, the state is also not, you know, making the money on the home. So this really is a program where the state is saying, you know, we're interested in opening up home ownership to groups that have historically been locked out. And we're actually willing to put some of our own skin in the game to make that happen.
I remember last time for round one. I mean, it was just kind of frenzied. It was a little crazy. Like that program, they used up all the money, I think, in less than 2 weeks. It was, I think, unsurprisingly quite popular. What happened exactly?
Yeah, so it actually ran out in 11 days. They had to put a pause on the program because they were running out of funds. And as you mentioned, it was a very, very popular program. The program was run on a first-come, first-served basis. So you had to be a first-time home buyer. You had to make 150% or less of the area median income. And, you know, once you qualified, basically these applications were approved on a first-come, first-served basis. And so what we heard from some realtors and brokers were that some people who got these loans were actually pretty far along in the home buying process because they had to move pretty quickly. So in some cases, they may have already been in contract on a home. And so this did raise the question.
Maybe already had the down payment in the bank already.
Exactly, right? You know, were these people who would have bought a home, whether they got help from this program or not? So the California Housing Finance Agency, which runs this program for the state, they say they don't have data to confirm those anecdotal reports, but they really do want to address at least the perception that this has been happening as they launch the program's next round.
Okay, so the next round is going to take place this spring. What are the big changes compared to last year?
So the major change is that there's going to be a lottery. So rather than first come, first serve, homebuyers, first of all, are going to have longer to prepare. So beginning now through April, they have about 4 months to go online on the CalHFA website, find a lender, get their pre-approval going, and prepare to submit their official application in April. Once they do that, beginning in early April, there will be a lottery. So they'll have a month to submit their applications. And then about 2,000 of the winners of that lottery will get vouchers that they can then use to buy a home within the next 60 days. So the idea, really, state officials say, is to give more time for those buyers who, you know, are really sitting there wondering if homeownership is something that's accessible to them, who find out about the program and really say, oh, this could actually make a difference. This could put us in the game where we weren't necessarily before. The other thing that's going to change is a geographic emphasis. So what we saw in the first round was there was this geographic disparity in terms of who is getting these homes. So you have LA County that has about a quarter of the state's population, and only about 9% of loans actually went to homebuyers in that county. So what state officials are looking at is actually setting aside vouchers for specific geographic areas based on their share of the state's population. And I'll just add another big shift that's happening is an emphasis on first generation home buyers. So, you know, part of the hope for this program on behalf of its supporters was that it would really disproportionately benefit certain communities of color who have had historically low home ownership rates because of racist redlining, because of a lack of generational wealth. And some of the loans in 2023 did go to these groups, like African-American and Latino Californians, but there's not necessarily evidence that those groups disproportionately benefited. And so one of the new things that the state is doing is actually saying, at least one person on your home buying team has to be a first generation home buyer. And so that's defined by somebody whose parents were not homeowners and they've also never owned a home. And so the idea there is to really open up homeownership to people who may have been frozen out in the past because of a lack of generational wealth.
Okay, so it seems like there were definitely some lessons learned when looking at the first round to the second round. A big change this year, we are facing a steep budget deficit. Is there any chance that this program gets rolled back?
Yeah, so there's always a chance. When we saw Governor Newsom put out his budget proposal this month, this program survived. And it survived at a time when a number of other housing programs were facing cuts, not only future budget cuts, but rollbacks of money that had already been appropriated. So for the California Dream for All program, so far so good. But as we know, over the course of the spring, there are going to be a lot more budget talks. The legislature will have a chance to weigh in. It's possible something might shift. But I know, you know, from speaking with officials at CalHAFA, they're feeling confident enough to really start planning the details of this rollout now.
And I know that eligibility, I mean, the criteria depends on what the median income is per county. That can vary greatly depending one county to the next. But you did have a good range in your reporting. Can you explain who is eligible, like what the threshold is for income and if credit scores actually matter?
Yeah, absolutely. So there has been a lowering of the income qualification ceiling. So it was originally 150% of the area median income last year. That's actually changing to 120% this year. So if you're in Sacramento County, that would be about $137,000 a year. It's going to be less if you're in, say, Fresno, hovering around more like $95,000. And then if you're in these, you know, very pricey areas in the Bay Area where people are making bigger incomes, that can go up to, you know, $200,000 plus in those areas. So it is a substantial range. And there's a tool that homebuyers can use to actually look up their AMI and see whether they would qualify or not.
You know, this program sounds awesome, but it's also can be complicated and daunting for people who didn't even think buying a home was even realistic or within their means in California. When you talk to realtors or just people who help people walk through the home buying process. I mean, are there challenges faced by first-time homebuyers, first-gen homebuyers, in understanding and applying for the program?
Absolutely. And I think some of the challenges are exactly what you said, either, you know, psychological or lack of information. I spoke with one realtor who said she had about a quarter of her clients were first-time homebuyers, and she really encouraged them to apply for the program last year. But she said, you know, this is an intimidating process for someone who is making probably the biggest financial investment that they'll ever make in their lives, right, for most regular folks. And it really was taking people a while to kind of get their hands around what really this program was. And in the end, nobody was able to apply in time to take advantage of the program. So I think that's partly why state officials are allowing for this longer rollout this time. They also say they're trying to some kind of creative and innovative outreach strategies to try and reach people, particularly in Southern California, who may not have been aware of the program before. So that includes things like putting flyers in laundromats, advertising on Spanish language radio, to really get the information about this program in front of as many people as possible.
Yeah, finally, you mentioned that the first round, it obviously didn't go as planned. There were some anecdotes that it maybe didn't go to people who necessarily needed it, but the data wasn't really there. So when it comes to the second round, ensuring that there's equity, ensuring that there's an equal distribution, are there measures in place to look back and ensure that the process is actually working as intended?
That's a great question. So I know CalHAFA is going to be looking at this very closely. And obviously, we reporters covering this are also going to be monitoring it closely. I know lawmakers came back in between the two rounds and really told the agency, we really want this first generation homebuyer emphasis to be in place. So that's something that we expect the legislature to be watching very closely as the program rolls out.
Felicia, thank you so much.
Thank you. Take care.
Felicia Mello is the California Divide reporter for CalMatters. Up next, the first California Senate debate was last night. We're going to analyze what each of the top four candidates had to say and if it moved the needle. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. There are four top candidates vying for the late Senator Dianne Feinstein's Senate seat. And last night, for the first time, Democratic Congressmembers Adam Schiff, Katie Porter, and Barbara Lee took the debate stage alongside Republican Steve Garvey, a former baseball player for the Dodgers and Padres. With less than 2 months until the primary, it's still a relatively close race. And in California, the top two candidates moved to the general election in November, regardless of party. The latest Berkeley IGS poll among likely voters, released earlier this month, shows Adam Schiff in the lead at 21%, Katie Porter in second at 17%, Republican Steve Garvey at 13%, and Barbara Lee with 9% of support. But there's still 21% of likely voters who remain undecided, which is the equivalent to Schiff's support. So did this debate last night move the needle? It was held at USC and sponsored by Politico, with senior political reporter Melanie Mason, its co-moderator. Melanie joins us now with some analysis. Welcome. Good job last night, Melanie.
Thank you. Thank you. It's great to be here.
It's a tough thing to be a moderator on for a debate. 100%. Did it go as you envisioned?
I joke. I was like kind of in a fugue state the whole time. Like after 90 minutes, I was like, did that just happen? I am very much a print reporter. And so just the whole television aspect of it all, it felt almost surreal. But I would say, like, you know, now having a couple of hours to digest and play back, I'm pretty happy with how it went. You know, we had a lot of topics that we wanted to cover. There were a lot of sort of points that we wanted to get to. And it still managed to be comprehensive and allowing some of those more feisty exchanges that I think are the things that everybody talks about the next day. So Yeah, I don't have any things that I'm replaying in my head thinking, oh, I should have done that instead. So that's pretty good.
When you were going over the topics with your co-moderator, Alex Michelson, he is an anchor at Fox 11 in Los Angeles. What did you want to get out of the first Senate debate for California?
I think the thing that we really were cognizant of was that this was the first time that all four candidates were going to be on stage together. And so this was kind of, for most people's opportunity to really tune into this debate, this race for the first time and get a sense for all these candidates. So while us political junkies know these candidates, particularly the elected members of Congress, very well, we've been following them for years, the general public doesn't. And so the balance that we wanted to strike was to allow for some introduction, to allow for the general public to get to know these candidates really for the first time on stage, but also to press them to try to make some news, to try to get them to refine or clarify some of the points that they have been making during this campaign. So it's a real balancing act between some of these more broader questions about issues that Californians care about, and then getting down to maybe more of the pointed political news of the day and getting them to weigh in there.
Yeah, I mean, we obviously, or you obviously covered broad topics, homelessness, you know, immigration, but you also got more nuance as well when talking about earmarks or the farm bill, you know, to really serve, you know, people who live all over the state. It's a huge state. And when it comes to the three Democratic candidates, I thought it was a good opportunity for them to differentiate themselves since they're all congressional members. And for Steve Garvey, I think for a lot of people, it's people kind of hearing him speak on political matters for the very first time. He is the Republican candidate, doesn't come with a political track record. So I just want to give listeners a sense of where he's coming from. And I'm going to play a clip and just let it breathe a little bit on why the former baseball player wants to be a California senator. And this is him responding to the question that you asked, having never served or wanting to give specifics about issues until after the primary. How can Californians know what they're getting with Steve Garvey? And this is his response.
I have said that I'm new. I needed to explore California. I needed to talk to the people. I needed to hear from them, their feelings about their elected officials. And that's what I've done. And policy for me is position. I've taken strong positions, especially on the homeless and what should be done. We should do a strong audit on that. I talked about, you know, the economy and inflation, rapid spending. Let's get back to energy that's affordable. I've talked about the border, the crisis at the border. Let's close the border. Let's take a deep breath. We have a pathway to citizenship. Let's enforce it. Crime. Let's get crime off the streets. Let's fund the police. Let's make sure that they keep our neighborhoods and our communities safe. I mean, That's policy, but it's my position, and by tomorrow, you'll see a lot more.
When I was listening to him speak and watching him speak, you know, he kind of reminded me of Ronald Reagan. What did you get from his performance at the debate last night?
The Reagan analogy, I think, is a really apt one. That was the one that was running through my head, too. It almost felt like there was kind of a nostalgia for what a Republican politician looked like, you know, decades ago. That was somebody who talked about optimism, who talked about, you know, sort of old kind of more traditional values, perhaps free markets, things like that, getting away from some of the more divisive areas that we've seen in our current politics. And so I think if there are people that are nostalgic for at least what they remember of those politics back in the day, which maybe wasn't totally what it was in reality, that might really have resonated, right? I mean, Garvey himself is somewhat of a nostalgic figure. He's this baseball legend. If you grew up watching, you know, the Dodgers or the Padres, or even if you weren't watching him play in real time, he's been for the past however many decades kind of this symbol of MLB here in California. And so I think that in some ways he's running on more of this persona than anything else, which is, don't you want your politician to be somebody who feels likable, who doesn't feel divisive, who isn't going to be yelling at the other side? And look, there's something to be said for that. I mean, I do think that people are really fed up with what is a lot of negative partisanship in politics these days. So I understand how, as a strategy, he might see that as appealing to voters. I think that the question is Can you then take that and articulate what that means for what you would do in the job as senator? And I think that that was a place where he struggled a little bit more, was sort of, instead of just being an avatar for maybe people's frustrations with politics, really presenting a, and here's how I would act in office if you chose me.
Yeah, he was light on details. And I think it even came to who he would vote for in the presidential race. I mean, he has voted for former President Trump twice, but he wouldn't commit on the debate stage whether he would vote for Trump a third time. And I want to play this clip because this is one of the more heated exchanges. I mean, the three Democrats on the stage obviously, you know, took issue with Garvey. So let's listen to him being questioned on, you know, whether he would support Donald Trump or Joe Biden as president.
At this point, Donald Trump has been president. Joe Biden has been president. We've seen both of them as president. Are you still undecided if the choice is Donald Trump versus Joe Biden? As you suggested to Politico, you may vote for Joe Biden. How are you undecided, and what would make that decision for you?
I didn't say that.
Okay, so what will clarify your view then?
When the time comes, I'll do exactly what I said to you. I will look at the two opponents. I will determine what they did, and at that time, I will make my choice. I don't believe Joe Biden has been good for this country. I heard it said that that Trump was terrible for the world, right?
Yeah.
He was.
That we were less safe. We were safer,
yeah,
more under him than we are under Biden. We're on three different platforms throughout the world.
So he's, Congressmember, he's arguing that that we were safer under President Trump. What do you make of what he just said, and what's your response?
Well, California, I think what they say is true. Once a Dodger, always a Dodger. He just chewed up 2.5 minutes of the time to talk about substantive issues in this debate and refused to answer the question. Ballots go out in 6 weeks, Mr. Garvey. This is not the minor leagues. Who will you vote for?
And that is Katie Porter challenging Steve Garvey. I mean, aside from the fact that he wouldn't go on the record or commit to who he would vote for, do you think that this is just pure strategy just to get through to the top two?
You know, I mean, there might be some sincerity behind it. I mean, there is, I think that there is, it feels almost a little bit quaint now, but a notion that like your vote is your personal private expression, you know, that's a thing about our democracy is we have secret ballots. You don't have to say who you voted for. And so maybe that is something that he truly believes, but it also does really feel like there's some political calculus behind it. But I have to tell you, it's a tough political calculus to figure out. It looks like he's really has his eye squarely on the electorate in November, the general election. You look at somebody like President Trump, he's not very popular overall in this state. He lost very handily to Joe Biden in 2020. And so he's thinking if he could win in November, he needs to win over people who are not Trump voters. But before November comes March, in the March primary, he has to get past the primary first. And the fact that he seems so squishy on where he what he feels about Trump will not resonate with Republican voters in this state. Remember, they have reason to turn out in the primary because there's a presidential primary on the ballot there among the Republicans. So if you're a Trump supporter listening to him speak and he's so squishy about it, what is going to motivate you to vote for him in March? And so this is this needle that he's trying to thread. And, you know, the old axiom in politics is that you kind of pander to your base in the primary and then you move to the center for the general. He seems to be trying to skip that part and going straight to the center. And maybe he thinks that just having the Republican behind his name is enough to consolidate that vote to get into the top two. But it's going to be an interesting math equation to get there.
Yeah, and it's important to just remind people that when it comes to voter registration, no party preference rivals the Republican Party in California. So maybe that's, you know, the strategy that he's using to try and pull people who are no party preference. You know, he also, on the debate stage, and I'm focusing on him because it's kind of like an introduction to him as a candidate, and this is the last clip I'm going to play of him. You know, he kind of lumped the three Democratic candidates all together, you know, as individuals. And there's this exchange about homelessness. And I want to play it because it captures the dynamic of that night. You know, the three Democratic candidates, they did go after Garvey, but Garvey also lumped them all together as the problem.
When was the last time any of you went to the inner city? actually walked up to the homeless, as I have over these last 3 weeks. I've gone to San Diego and Los Angeles and Sacramento. And actually, because this is part of, you know, I'm not a politician, but I needed to talk to the people of the city. I needed to talk to the homeless, went up to them and touched them and listened to them. And you know what? They looked at me and they said, "You're the first time anybody's come up and asked us about our life." The homeless man who spent 5 years on the street in Sacramento. They don't get it. When I go back to the Senate, a year from now, when I'm your next elected U.S. Senator from California, the first thing I'll do is an audit. Where have the $30 billion the federal government has spent? And by the way, these are career politicians that talk about Washington being dysfunctional.
Thank you, Mr. Garvey.
You're Washington.
I know I'm the youngest person on this stage, but my career didn't just last 5 years. I was elected to Congress 5 years ago. I am not a career politician, but I'm proud of the work I've done in Congress.
Congresswoman, we need to let Mr. Schiff get in there.
And I've just got to say, as somebody who's been unsheltered, I cannot believe how he described his walk and touching and being there with the homeless. Come on, Mr.
First of all, and this will be my one and only baseball analogy for the evening.
Okay.
Mr. Garvey, I'm sorry, that was a total swing and a miss. That was a total whiff of an answer. And I say that, you know, credit where credit is due, you are a hell of a ball player.
All right, so that was at first Katie Porter, and then Barbara Lee, and then finally with Adam Schiff. There were a lot of baseball references, Melanie. What did you make of those? I would imagine maybe you would have expected them, but were you? Did you enjoy them?
We definitely expected them. I will say that as a personal Dodger fan, I'm from Los Angeles, and I'm a diehard Dodger fan. When Katie Porter, you know, used Dodger as an insult to Steve Garvey, there was a part of me that just that cringed a little bit. But that's my own baseball biases coming through. But yeah, I mean, look, obviously we were expecting some puns. Some were better than others. But I think that what was interesting in that clip is, to your point, he was lumping all three of those Democrats together as career politicians. There's no, you know, nobody is ever going to get dinged with ragging on Washington, ragging on politicians, because Congress politicians typically not very popular. I did think it was interesting then to see even Congresswoman Porter, who does serve in Congress, trying to actually take a similar line and accuse her other two Democratic rivals who have been in Congress longer as they're the Washington establishment, they're Washington. I may have, you know, representative as my title, but I also don't represent kind of the typical politician. So you can see threads of Garvey's strategy in what Porter was saying as well. And maybe that's not something we would have anticipated going into this debate.
Moving to the three Democratic candidates, I mean, do you think that they were successful in becoming individuals on the stage? I mean, they're all congressional colleagues.
It's tough because they vote together so much, trying to tease out the policy differences between them. It means either going real deep into the weeds or on some major issues. I mean, obviously, the Israel-Hamas war is one place where we do see some serious differentiation. And I think that was an area in particular where you saw Congresswoman Barbara Lee, who was the first to call for an immediate and permanent ceasefire and really sort of tap into what is sort of the position of most of the progressive flank of the Democratic Party at this point. I felt like she really got energized in that issue, in that question. And I think she saw that as a moment for her to break away from her other two Democrats. And I think that the question of earmarks was kind of an interesting and maybe unexpected way that we saw Congresswoman Porter trying to differentiate herself. I mean, that's a pretty wonky procedural conversation about directed spending that, you know, Congress members can request for their districts. But I think what it was trying to do when she brings this up as an issue is put some daylight between her and these other two Democrats to say, here's how I view how Washington works, and I would do it differently. So there were these choice moments where, yes, they would find the issue and put daylight between them and the other Democrats. But the truth is as we mentioned sort of at the start of the debate, they vote together 90% of the time or more. The truth is that if any of them get elected to the Senate, we can expect that they will vote very similarly. So it's more a question of like what their priorities are and how they would approach the job that I think is what is going to distinguish a Senator Schiff from a Senator Porter from a Senator Lee.
Yeah, which makes it difficult when they're all running against each other for one position. I think one of the loudest examples of trying to differentiate themselves from each other involves Katie Porter, currently polling in second, and criticizing Adam Schiff when it comes to oil. So let's take a listen to that.
Representative Schiff, I didn't realize how much dirty money you took until I was running against you. You've taken money from big oil, big pharma, cable companies, and other industries.
All right, we're going to keep moving.
Representative Schiff may have prosecuted big oil companies before he came to Congress, but when he got to Congress, he cashed checks from companies like BP, from fossil fuel companies. I have delivered results on climate in my few years in Congress. I have raised the rate. My legislation to raise the rate on polluters when they drill on our public lands was signed into law.
I gave that money to you, Katie Porter. And I wasn't in office when you were taking fossil fuels.
The
only response I got was thank you, thank you, thank you. But look, at the end of the day, it's about what have you gotten done? I didn't hear anything from Representative Porter about anything she's actually accomplished.
You know, when it comes to that exchange, and I just think overall, like any, I mean, that wasn't the only kind of maybe jab that Katie Porter tried. I mean, I know that she criticized Adam Schiff on abortion as well, other issues as well. But he is currently polling in first. I mean, he appeared to stay calm, firm, collected. I mean, how do you think his performance was last night?
I think what Congressman Schiff had to do was make no major errors. And he didn't. I think he had a very smooth debate. I think that he was able to parry the questions pretty well. I think that he was able to have a few key moments. Did he win over voters that maybe weren't going to be on his side? I'm not so sure. But did he lose voters that were with him, that are giving him his polling lead right now? I don't think so. So I think that if you're, you know, if you have the lead, you're playing to hold on to the lead. And I think that he accomplished that. And I think that the question was Katie Porter, in being sort of more scrappy, did she maybe pull away voters from him, or perhaps did she win over voters who were perhaps thinking about Congresswoman Lee, thinking of them as maybe the two progressive choices in the race? And is that going to be enough for her to consolidate enough votes to get into that top two?
When it comes to Congressmember Barbara Lee, I mean, who's currently polling in fourth, she is the most senior Congressmember. Do you think this debate helped her?
You know, I think that that really remains to be seen. I'm going to be really interested to see the next round of polling. And more importantly, I think if she gets any boost in fundraising, because her biggest problem is that she needs to get her name and her message out there. Congressman Schiff has so much money. He just has this gigantic, he has $35 million on hand as of the end of the year, this war chest. And we see he's already booked $10 million in airtime between now and the primary. He's going to be able to blanket the state with his message. Congressman Porter doesn't have quite as much money, but still a pretty healthy fundraising. She's up on air and she's advertising. Congresswoman Lee needs the type of resources in order to get her message out there. I think that she could say that positions like what she has on the ceasefire, for example, or a Medicare for All position or other areas might really resonate with the progressive part of this state, which is a pretty sizable one in a state as Democratic as California. But if they don't hear her message or they don't get to know that she's a viable candidate in this race, then that doesn't really get her anywhere. So maybe she saw an outpouring in small dollar donations last night. We haven't heard that yet from the campaign, but you know, if they want to leak any fundraising numbers, I'm happy to take them. But that, I think, to me, is the big question for her going forward.
Finally, Melanie, you know, those 90 minutes, it went by really fast. You know, should voters be satisfied with what these candidates had to say?
Well, I think voters should never be satisfied. They should always be asking for more information from their candidates. And the good news is that we know that there are going to be additional debates. I believe that I saw that the next one will be on February 12th. So there is going to be more opportunity. But I also think that voters should be pressing them, you know, going to campaign events, pressing them to do more interviews. This is a very self-interested pitch to, you know, appeal to their politicians, to talk to journalists more. I would like to think that in this debate, there was a lot of information that people got that could help them shape their choices. But my feeling is the more information, the better, the more opportunity for them to air out these differences and to sell their ideas, the better. And so I'm looking forward to seeing what happens in the next debate.
Melanie, thanks for making the time for us. I know it's been a busy 24 hours for you.
I'm going to go take a nap. Thank you.
Well deserved. Melanie Mason is a senior political reporter with Politico who co-moderated the first Senate debate last night among the four leading candidates, Democratic Congress members Adam Schiff, Katie Porter, Barbara Lee, as well as Republican Steve Garvey. Up next, the nation's oldest and most prestigious science competition is spotlighting local talent. We'll meet a Mira Loma High School student and learn about his original research. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment. Welcome back to Insight on.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. For many high school students, the chance to do hands-on work outside of the classroom, hone new skills, explore scientific fields, is a tremendous learning opportunity. And that work also comes with recognition. And for a lucky few, that includes the nation's oldest and most prestigious math and science competition. Each year, the Regeneron Science Talent Search names 300 high school students as scholars. The competition has been running since 1942, and has provided millions of dollars in awards. And the 2024 cohort, which was announced earlier this month, includes local talent right here in Sacramento. Hari Srikanth is a senior at Mira Loma High School, and he joins us now to talk more about his original work. Good afternoon.
Hi, Vicky. Nice to be on.
Thank you for taking the time to talk with us, and congratulations on this accomplishment. For people who are just learning about this for the first time, what is the Regeneron Science Talent Search?
The Regeneron Science Talent Search, as you mentioned, is one of the oldest competitions in the nation to recognize science and research and scholarship. The process involves submitting your original research work and a lot of additional information and essays that detail your role as an innovator and as a leader in the scientific community.
How long have you been working towards this goal and towards this accomplishment? When did you first become aware of this?
Well, I started my research that I submitted for Regeneron right before I entered freshman year of high school. So it's been a really long time coming. I worked on one part of my project for around 2 years and on the other part of the project for the remaining 2 years.
I would love to learn about your research. I mean, the project name formally is Multimodal Computer Vision and Novel Reinforcement Learning for Robot Navigation in Fires. But when you explain it, which I'm going to have you do, I mean, it's going to be really useful for people that are in dangerous situations, that are caught in structure fires. Tell us how it works.
Yeah. Well, I know the title's a bit of a mouthful, but there's really just two main ideas that are contained within the project description. There's a perception system, which involves the idea of robot. So the main project overall is robot perception and navigation in fire. So it's helping robot systems navigate through burning buildings to locate and identify where trapped inhabitants could be, to hopefully give that information to firefighters so that they can rescue them when the time comes. So there's two parts to how I'm achieving that. The first aspect of that is something called perception, where the robotic system needs to navigate through a system as complex as a burning building. And there's a lot of challenges that come with that. The main one that I had to deal with was smoke, because a lot of robot perception systems use something called LIDAR, where it uses laser systems to scan and map the environment around it. So what I did was I developed a novel mapping system that combined LIDAR with sonar to overcome a lot of the resistance that was faced by these systems, which enabled the system to navigate and perceive its surroundings to hopefully better move through the area. The second half of the project is using something called reinforcement learning to path plan and navigate its way through the burning building. So reinforcement learning is the machine learning technology at the core of ChatGPT, Google self-driving cars, and a lot of other main machine learning technologies like chess solvers. And it's the idea behind it is very simple. There's an actor which comes up with ideas for how a robotic system should act, And then there's a critic, which tells the actor how well the system is performing. So traditionally, a lot of reinforcement learning systems use very complex mathematical structures called neural networks to estimate the performance and value of these algorithms. But my assumption was that this was overkill for a lot of the simpler applications like robotic navigation or path planning. You know, it's not going to be like doing something like ChatGPT. It's something a lot more down to earth. So what I did was I used some statistical techniques to simplify the critic step, which enabled me to outspeed some of the leading reinforcement learning algorithms in the world by 20% on my target use case. So that really helped actually run the path planning on board the drones, which is a major part of what my research contributed.
Yeah, I mean, as I'm just listening to you, there is a lot that is involved in this. And this has spanned years for you of research and work. But ultimately, I mean, at its core is to help people who are trapped inside a structure fire, inside a building. What inspired you to go down this route?
Yeah, well, here in Sacramento, you know, we're kind of no strangers to fires. I remember once when I was in middle school, the smoke just completely shut down our school for a few days, where we had the Paradise and Caldor fires, where actually people that I even knew had to leave their homes. They had to relocate for summers or weeks or months even on end. So it's something that I began to realize was, I saw it a lot in the community of Sacramento. And when I turned my research to kind of see, you know, where else is it affecting, I realized that structure fires are a growing problem just in general. It's just been on the rise for the past few years. And it means that robotic systems that can hopefully assist with that challenge are going to be more and more important in the future.
Yeah. I mean, as you're doing all this work over your time in high school, I mean, you're also thinking about submitting for this competition that is incredibly prestigious. I mean, there are Nobel Prize winners and other distinguished individuals who have been part of this and have been selected over the years and decades. And this is, as you described, a very intensive process. When you actually found out that you crossed, you know, one of the finish lines, you were named as one of the 300 scholars. How did that feel?
Well, I was, you know, it was kind of a very unexpected thing for me. I woke up that morning and I had to be home because I was finishing some work for some of my college applications. And I just checked my phone and I saw the email that I was selected as a scholar. And I was super excited. I came down, told my mom, I called my dad, called my sister. I was really excited about the general opportunity because I'd submitted for it a few months ago. But then when I finally got the confirmation that I was selected as a scholar, I was very happy to join the community, join the alumni network, and hopefully connect with a lot of the great people and talented individuals that are part of the Regeneron Science Talent Search Program.
And this week is a pretty big moment as well, because I believe on Wednesday you'll find out if you have been narrowed down to the top 40, correct?
Yeah. And, you know, the finalist is another, it's a very great option. It's a great opportunity because the finalists are invited to present their projects at Washington, D.C., some of the leading professionals in their industry worldwide. And it's something that I'm looking forward to finding out tomorrow.
When it comes to just your passion for science and for research, robotics also, where did that come from? When did that start for you? I mean, how old were you? Were you like a little hurry when you had this passion for STEM?
I think when I was young, my parents really emphasized the idea of exploration. So I got to experiment with a lot of different things, from sports to arts to piano to, and then it kind of led me to robotics. The big thing for me with engineering was I love my Legos, and they kind of helped me see engineering in a very creative way. It wasn't just application of theory and concepts, but it's also creating some new projects. And that's what's really been drawing me towards engineering. Since then, I developed my engineering background through activities like Science Olympiad with Mira Loma High School and through my robotics team, the FM49ers. And I've kind of used those opportunities along with a bunch of different projects to grow as an engineer and an innovator.
All right. So you get out of the classroom, you know, you put down the laptop or the computer. What other hobbies do you have? What do you enjoy doing?
Yeah, well, as I mentioned, I love to keep in touch with my creative side. I've been playing piano for the past 7 or 8 years. And, you know, I just play more recreationally, and I just pick a couple of songs that I like to experiment with that. I've also pretty much into creative writing. I've always been drafting stories since I was really young, but over the past few years, I've started really annotating them down and compiling them all together in a bunch of different notebooks.
Yeah.
That's awesome. And, you know, creativity, of course, there's creativity in science as well. Sometimes people think that, you know, they're different or, you know, mutually exclusive, but that's not the case. Finally, you know, you're a senior in high school and you've already accomplished so much. You haven't even graduated yet. What advice do you have for, you know, someone who's a freshman or in middle school that's listening to this and, you know, is interested in getting involved in research, but maybe it's a little intimidating and they don't know where to start?
I think my biggest recommendation is once you have like a couple of different skills, once you're skilled enough to like know what you're exploring, my recommendation is just to go straight into projects and don't be scared to challenge yourself. Don't be scared to fail. I know for me, I had a lot of different setbacks. I just intended to create a system and I was super surprised when my robotic system couldn't even navigate in smoke. But whenever you come into those challenges, it's a great learning opportunity. My entire research is kind of built around the idea of overcoming these challenges, of bringing complex algorithms like reinforcement learning to my own practical robots, or of navigating these complex environments. In general, whenever there's a challenge, whenever you're doing it by yourself and you're kind of working through these projects, I think you learn more than you could just through textbooks or rote memorization or anything like that.
Hari, thank you so much for joining us. We'll be thinking of you on Wednesday. I hope you check in and let us know how it goes.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that.
Hari,
pretty nervous about it.
Oh, well, you don't have to be. You're a winner in our eyes, but we will definitely be keeping our fingers crossed for you. Hari Srikanth is a senior at Mira Loma High School and is one of this year's 300 Regeneron Science Talent Search Scholars. And on Wednesday, he'll find out if he's in the top 40. That is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. If you want to join the conversation, email us at insight@capradio.org. Thank you to producer Sarit Lashinsky and managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital producer and audio engineer is Chris Phelps. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our show music is produced by Adrian Gilmore. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great Tuesday. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.